All right, good afternoon. Welcome to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's program today, featuring Ebenezer Adeyemi. Thank you for joining us in person and on live stream today. My name is Ted Powers. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology and an Iowa City Foreign Relations Council Program Committee member, and I'll be the host for today's program. This year, we're celebrating the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's 40th anniversary. We have some great plans for this year with a total of four events devoted to celebrating our supporters, our legacy in the community, and the bright future ahead for internationally focused programming. We hope that you will check on our website, sign up for our monthly newsletters, and follow us on social media to learn more about the exciting things that are happening this year. Today's program is a part of our new 2023-2024 series, Global Connections Across Iowa, which is funded in part by Humanities Iowa and the National Endowment for the Humanities. We hope that you will join us for upcoming two programs in this series. More information on these events can be found on our website. For today's program, we would ask you two things. First, if you are willing, there are paper copies of the Humanities Iowa sign-in form. It'd be great if you could add your name and contact information to one of those. I think many of you have already done that, and thank you. Second, after the program, there are paper copies of the Humanities Iowa program survey. We would appreciate it very much if you could fill one out and leave that with us. The Iowa City Foreign Relations Council wants to acknowledge and thank its annual donors, sponsors, and partners for their support. This list includes the Iowa Arts Council through the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs, Humanities Iowa, and the National Endowment for the Humanities, the University of Iowa's International Programs, Honors Program, and Public Policy Center, the Stanley UI Foundation support organization, Midwest One Bank, Taxes Plus, City Channel 4 for providing online access to ICRFC's programs, along with the UI Library Archives, the Iowa City Public Library for a wonderful new home, and last but certainly not least are the longstanding support of individuals who have helped our organization grow for the past 40 years, some of whom are with us in the audience today. Thank you. We also would like to address the Native American Land Acknowledgement. The Iowa City Foreign Relations Council has adopted the Native American Land Acknowledgement prepared for the City of Iowa's Ad Hoc Truth and Reconciliation Commission and Human Rights Commission. The Iowa City Foreign Relations Council recognizes that our home community of Iowa City, and I quote, now occupies the homelands of Native American nations to whom we owe our commitment and dedication, end quote. The full text of the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's acknowledgement is available on our website at icfrc.org. I'd now like to introduce our speaker. Ebenezer Olamaposi Adeyemi is a doctoral candidate in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Iowa, and I am his advisor, proudly his advisor. Ebenezer holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in Anthropology and a Master's degree in Peace and Conflict Studies, both from the University of Ibadan in Nigeria. He also received a Master's degree in Anthropology from the University of Iowa in May 2021. His broad research interests center on medical anthropology, infrastructure, and the intersection of urban landscape and public health, as analyzed through the lens of African studies and survival strategies in marginalized communities. For his ongoing doctoral research, Ebenezer is exploring the strategies and residents of Makoko, a large informal settlement characterized by inadequate public infrastructure, including a lack of waste disposal systems, public hospitals, in Lagos State, Nigeria. And of course, the focus here is on access to healthcare to treat malaria, the most prominent public health issue in this community. As an aside, I would just like to underscore that Ebenezer has done an excellent job securing external funding, having held a fellowship with the Dumbarton Oaks Institute, which is a Harvard University Library Institute, as well as from the Wennergren Foundation for Anthropological Research, broadly seen as the most prominent form and esteemed funding for doctoral research available to anthropologists. Please join me in welcoming Ebenezer Adeyemi, who will now talk about people science, community response to public health crises in Lagos, Nigeria.
Thank you, Professor Powers, for that introduction. Good evening from Nigeria. Good afternoon to everybody who is joining from Iowa City today. And I say good day to everybody who is joining from different parts of the world. I have titled my talk today, People's Science, Community-Based Response to Public Health Crisis in Lagos, Nigeria. And today, specifically, just like Prof. Power said, I'll be focusing on a public health crisis, which is malaria, which has been ravaging the country for hundreds of years. And the focus of my talk today is just to sort of talk about how socioeconomic inequality contributes, you know, to this crisis and shapes the dynamics of this of the public health crisis, which is malaria. Specifically, how you know some communities are much more affected by this epidemic, much more than other communities in the same Lagos. So my focus will also be in Lagos State, Nigeria today. I will still get to talk more about Lagos and Nigeria itself, with the understanding that we have a diverse audience. Many people might not be very familiar with Nigeria or Lagos State as a state in Nigeria. So I'll be talking briefly about these two places. But just to start, I would like to give a background as to why I became interested in malaria research. I grew up in southwestern Nigeria. And while I was growing up, I myself battled with malaria a couple times, like several times. And this developed my interest in this particular disease. While there are so many, you know, infectious diseases that affect children in Nigeria, malaria seems to be very, very big in scope and in terms of its socioeconomic impact. So while I myself battled with malaria several times when I was growing up, I noticed a very, very specific dynamic in terms of response to malaria. I noticed that malaria is a very treatable disease. And unfortunately, a lot of people die from malaria, which is very, very avoidable. So I developed interest in some of the questions about, you know, how socioeconomic inequality contributes or shape people's response to this disease. And I also developed a lot of interest in how the impact of socioeconomic inequality on health outcome. And also, given the disparities in resources that I witnessed as a growing kid in southwestern Nigeria, I also developed a lot of interest in strategies that people who live in marginalized urban communities used to access healthcare despite government marginalization. So, and to sort of say a little bit about malaria, according to the World Health Organization, 95% of malaria cases are in African region. That is a statistic that came out very recently in this year, 2023. And malaria, of course, is a disease that is transmitted by mosquitoes, but specifically by a variant of mosquito that is called Anopheles mosquitoes. And by my left, there's a picture which I took here at the Institute of Medical Research, where I also come, you know, to sort of do data analysis and, you know, speak to experts about the topic of malaria. So very recently, another variant of Anopheles mosquito that can transmit malaria was detected by scientists in this institute. And another fact that interests me a lot is the fact that Nigeria has the highest number of malaria infection and deaths globally. According to the 2020 World Malaria Report, Nigeria accounts for 27% of malaria infection and 23% of malaria deaths globally. And according to the World Health Organization again, malaria is more, while everybody is susceptible to malaria in Nigeria, people who live in places that the World Health Organization calls high transmission areas are much more susceptible to malaria infection and death due to a lot of factors like government marginalization, inadequate infrastructure. And also recently, I just talked about the World Malaria Report by the WHO, which was released in 2020. But very recently, I stumbled on another malaria report, which is much more recent. The 2022 malaria report, World Malaria Report by the World Health Organization. And I noticed an upward review in terms of my number of cases and the number of deaths that are recorded in Nigeria. According to the recent WHO report, Nigeria accounts for 31% of malaria deaths in the year 2021 that the 2022 report covers. And as you can see, about four African countries contribute over 50% of malaria deaths globally, the first being Nigeria, 31%, followed by Democratic Republic of Congo on 13%, and Tanzania, 4%, and Niger Republic on 4%. So, like I said, I'll be talking a lot more about Nigeria. My focus today is on Nigeria, and specifically Lagos. So just a little bit about Nigeria. Nigeria is part of the West African sub-region, and up until October 1st, 1960, Nigeria was a British colony. The country attained independence from British rule and became a sovereign independent nation in the year 1960. The name Nigeria was coined by the British colonial administrators in 1940. Before colonialism, there was nothing like Nigeria. So we have people of different political units existing as independent units across the country. But according to a lot of historians who have written about, colonialism in Nigeria, it has been said that the British colonial administrators actually amalgamated different political units in Nigeria for easy governance. And also, presently, Nigeria is the most populous African country with an estimated population of 200 million people. It has 33 states, with Abuja as the federal capital territory. Nigeria is a very diverse country. Well, it is a multilingual and a multi-ethnic country. And according to this scholar, Modimo 2015, presently Nigeria has over 521 languages and ethnic groups in the country. And of course, one of the legacies of British colonialism is the fact that presently today, because we have different people who speak different languages and belong to identify with different ethnicities, English has been adopted as the official language of the country and the lingua franca. So, and very brief note on Lagos, which my talk will also be focusing on today. Up until the 1990s, Lagos was the capital of Nigeria, and it was the British administrative capital during the colonial era. Lagos is reputed as the Nigerian economic hub and the most populous state in the country, and arguably on the African continent, with an estimated population of 22 million people. And one of the major things that are very visible for anybody that comes to Lagos and goes around Lagos is that due to the growing population, there is infrastructural deficit, that is not enough to cater for the needs of everybody that is in the city. And of course, one of the major characteristics of Lagos is the visibility of socioeconomic inequality, which I will still be talking about today. So in my quest to understand some of the origins of the socioeconomic inequality that sort of that impacts people's health and that sort of that shapes the dynamic of people's response to public health crisis, I have done a deep dive into the study of urban policies, government policies during the colonial era. I specifically focused on government policies on housing, on health, and on urban planning generally. So, and in my deep dive to the archives in Nigeria, I found a lot of interesting documents, and of course, a lot of scholars have written about how during the colonial period in Nigeria, during the British colonial period, there was huge urban planning segregation, in the sense that The majority of medical infrastructure, including hospitals and some of the basic amenities like street lights, pipe and water, were concentrated in elitist settlements where the British elite and the indigenous elites that worked with them were residing. So what we see during the colonial period in Nigeria, in Lagos specifically, which was the administrative capital of British colonialists, was the fact that indigenous elites and colonial elites lived in well-furnished parts of Lagos with the abundance of basic facilities, which I've mentioned today. And several of these colonized peoples lived on the margins of the city, like Makoko, which is my present doctoral field site that I will still be talking about in a moment. So many colonized peoples lived in places where they were susceptible to infectious diseases, including malaria. So and there were a lot of policies. Instead of the colonial officials to sort of focus on how to improve the livelihood of the people, there were a lot of policies that were introduced by colonial officials aimed at evicting poor people from their place, from their places of residence. They brought a lot of names like slum clearance, urban developments, just to mention a few. And this is just like a document that I got from the archives, from the National Archives at the University of Ibadan in Nigeria, which also happens to be my alma mater. Here, the colonial official is essentially justifying why it is important for colonial officials to live in places that are considered high standard, the places that are considered to have high standard residents. And also, it was essentially saying there should not be any problem, there should not be any reason to have any legal battle about the fact that government, that is the colonial government, was trying to acquire high standard residences primarily for the government officials, that is the colonial officials, and the indigenous elites that work with them. So, and this is another document, that is justifying why the government needs to be careful so that the poorer built houses, which the indigenous elites were, the poor colonized peoples were living in, should not overrun better type housing, which the colonial officials were living in, and also the indigenous elite that worked with them. So there was a lot of socioeconomic inequality that pushed people into situations where they were living in places where they were highly susceptible to infectious diseases. And of course, their response to such diseases were impacted because they were deeply marginalized by the colonial officials. So, fast forward to today, like I said earlier, Nigeria attained independence from British officials, British government in 1960. And presently, the country is being run by, indigenous elites. And what we see in Lagos and in the entire Nigeria is a continuation of some of the urban planning and housing segregation that we saw in the colonial period. And for instance, as of today, Lagos still has a huge deficit of infrastructure. And also, what we see in Lagos today is a situation whereby, of course, like I said, there is infrastructural deficit in Lagos, but government spending on infrastructure like hospital, like waste disposal system, are concentrated in affluent neighborhoods where the current social, economic, and political elite reside. I will still be showing pictures about some of these dynamics in the following slides. And there is abundance of basic infrastructure like good waste disposal systems in so many of these elitist neighborhoods. And we have a situation in Lagos where we have Lagos Island and the big Lagos mainland. When you talk about the Lagos Island, it's like what we call a downtown in United States context. You see a situation where many of the elites reside on the Lagos Highland, and you also see a lot of corporations, multinational corporations, their headquarters on the Lagos Island, including the United States government embassy. It's also situated on the Lagos Highland, where many of the elite live. Whereas when you come to the mainland, that is where you get to see a lot of deeply, hugely marginalized communities. And also, what we see in today's Lagos, just like it was in colonial period, is a situation of inadequate infrastructure in poor neighborhoods. And of course, due to all of these reasons, there is high susceptibility to infectious diseases like malaria in poor neighborhoods, which I'll still be talking about. So here's an example of an elitist, what I call elitist neighborhood in Lagos, Banana Island. Banana Island was created by a former Lagos state governor and who also rose to become the minister, the federal minister of works and housing. And when this island was created, the person who was, you know, set to create the island, the former Lagos state government, specifically mentioned that the island was created as a heaven on earth for the super rich who want to experience heaven before going to heaven. In this island today, as at 4 years ago, if you want to acquire property inside this island, I think you would need to have at least $1.5 million. So this island is where most many social and political elites and even the economic elite reside in Lagos. And the difference in infrastructure, especially health infrastructure, in this kind of island is very, very different from, say, a poor neighborhood in Lagos. So I will be showing pictures of some of these affluent neighborhoods to sort of give a visual representation of the kind of socioeconomic disparities that shape health outcome in Lagos. So here's a picture of Banana Island. Here's another picture of Banana Island, which is where a lot of very, very rich people reside in Lagos. Another picture of Banana Island in Lagos. And here is another place, Victoria Island, where the United States Embassy is situated. This place is also reputed to be one of the richest neighborhood in Nigeria and even in the entire world. So here are other pictures of Victoria Island. Another affluent neighborhood in Lagos is Ikoyi, where government officials, very wealthy people also reside. And you see a lot of difference in as regards infrastructure in this settlement and other poor neighborhoods in Lagos. This is Ikoyi. This is another picture of Ikoyi in Nigeria. And of course, it's very, very expensive to acquire property in these places. So, and moving to what I really want to focus on today, which is the concept of the talk about Makoko, which is my doctoral thesis, as an example of malaria high transmission area. Makoko, just a little information about Makoko. Makoko is my doctoral field site. I've been working in the community since 2019, August, when I started my PhD at the University of Iowa. It's a very large informal settlement in Yaba, in Lagos State, Nigeria. Official record puts the population of Makoko at 100,000 people. But from my interactions with the people and from what I've gathered on the ground, it is very likely that the community has about 300,000 people. And it's a hugely marginalized urban community. And the community is characterized by the building, it's characterized by building with stilts on the border of Lagos Lagoon. So that is the waterfront section that people stay in that community. People primarily transport themselves through the use of locally made canoes. And also, like I said earlier, the community is characterized by inadequate infrastructure, including hospitals, and the economy of the community is very diverse, with fishing being the mainstay, but there are also other economic activities like trading, like artisan work and stuff like that. So, and because of the nature of the community, which I will also be showing in pictures very soon, there is high susceptibility to infectious diseases. From my ethnographic research in the community so far, I've come to realize that malaria is the biggest public health issue in the community. And of course, because this is a community that is hugely marginalized by government, we see a huge presence of nonprofit organizations and NGOs who are trying to fill some of the gaps that are created by the absence of government in this community. So here's a picture of Makoko, the grand section of the community, just to sort of serve as a comparison with some of the pictures I showed earlier. And here's another picture of Makoko. It's another characteristic that I didn't mention is the fact that we tend to see a lot of waterlogged places, and there is huge presence of large puddles, especially during heavy rainfall. So here's another picture of how the community looked like. On this day, I took this picture. I think it just finished raining about 20 to 30 minutes ago, and so many places were flooded and waterlogged. So here's another picture of the waterfront section where the primary means of transportation is locally made canoes. Here's another picture here that I took during my fieldwork in 2021. Here's another picture. Here's another picture of Makoko. Can people still hear me? Can you hear me?
Can you hear us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you well, Ebenezer.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Given the background that I've just given, malaria being the biggest public health issue, this community gets almost nothing from the government. I mean, people joke around when I'm in the community, they're like, we only see government every 4 years when it's time to come beg us for votes. But after the elections, we don't see any government, including the state and the federal elected officials. So the fact is that malaria is a very big problem in the community. And in a situation of very big marginalization. So I was very interested particularly in how this community, despite government marginalization, despite the fact that they don't get infrastructure from government compared to other affluent neighborhoods in Lagos, I was interested in what are some of the strategies that the people use to sort of, manage the malaria epidemic in their community and to also treat themselves when they get infected with the disease. I'm also very interested in what are some of the things that the people do in the first place to sort of reduce their susceptibility to malaria. So I've come to understand that there are several community-led initiatives in the community for building health infrastructure. And some of these health infrastructures include makeshift hospitals, makeshift clinic, and stuff like that, and to sort of reduce their susceptibility to malaria as a disease. The people also have a varying amount of community-led initiative for building infrastructure, including waste disposal systems and sampling of large puddles and waterlogged areas, which serve as breeding sites for mosquitoes to sort of reduce their susceptibility to the disease. And also there's a lot of initiative geared towards sort of improving the environmental sanitation of the community. And I also have come to realize that there are artisans in the community that make locally made mosquito nets and coils to sort of protect children and everybody from exposure to mosquito bites, and of course to prevent them from getting malaria. So there are also community built waste disposal systems. And a terminology, a concept that I've been trying to work with ever since I started my projects in the community is the concept of community developed infrastructure. So the way I'm presenting this concept is to say, in a situation whereby people don't get anything from government, who is constitutionally empowered to provide infrastructure, health infrastructure, basic infrastructure for the citizens? How are the people doing it? And the people tend to tell me Oh, we are our own, we are, we do the, we do all these things for ourselves. So, and I'm using the concept of community developed infrastructure to theorize and to sort of frame these numerous community-based initiatives that the people are using to build infrastructure to sort of reduce their susceptibility to mosquito bites and reduce their chances of contracting malaria. So, and another concept that is really central to my work is the concept of people's science. So people's science is a concept that is attributed to anthropologists, to this anthropologist. It was coined in 2016. Richard used the concept of people's science to theorize local approaches, including the creation of local hydration techniques that people, local communities that were affected, that were most affected by the Ebola crisis, the Ebola epidemic in 2013, from 2013 to 2015. And the most affected countries, of course, at that time were Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. So Richard is using this concept of people's science to talk about local approaches and local technologies that the people adopted to manage the epidemic, to put it under check long before the coming of international assistance. And one of the arguments that this anthropologist is making is the fact that the people developed epidemiological knowledge of the disease, which was trained to them at that time. And of course, when we hear about global health, success stories in global health, we don't hear about these local approaches. We hear about all the World Health Organization treaties. They built this hospital in this community, but we don't hear about the ingenious mechanisms that the people are putting in place to manage community problems. So, going back to my field site in Bamako, I'm theorizing some of the activities like this concept of community development infrastructure, that is several community-based initiatives that the people use to build infrastructure to cater for their health needs in the community. As people's science, which is under-theorized and also less celebrated. And I also wanted to say something very briefly about my research, because when I talk about my research in different contexts, I get a lot of questions as to what specifically is the goal of my research. Why am I interested in strategies that people use to access healthcare in marginalized urban communities? So the goal of my research is to show, in a sense, that socioeconomic inequality is not a Nigerian phenomenon. It's not something that is unique to Nigeria. And I think this also ties very seamlessly with the theme of this series, which is Global Connection. Socioeconomic inequality is a global phenomenon. Of course, it can be seen in different fashions, in different environments, in different contexts. But what I'm trying to do with my work is not to, add to the Afro-pessimistic framing of African cities. However, to say, oh, this is a global phenomenon, so as socioeconomic inequality is also a global phenomenon. And I'm also trying to show in my research how health outcomes are shaped by a wide array of socioeconomic factors globally. And again, this is not something that is restricted to Nigeria. This is something that is seen all over the world, as we can see with the example of COVID-19, that even in the United States, societies, some neighborhoods were disproportionately affected by this COVID-19 pandemic, and their response were also, sort of impacted by historic socioeconomic inequality. And what I'm also trying to do in my work is the fact that while a lot of scholars have framed communities like my field site as site of disease, as site of precarity, as site of chaos, you see a lot of creativity going on in these marginal spaces. And what I'm much more interested in is to sort of talk about the creative endeavors that the people are, carrying out, and not to celebrate informality or poverty. So my own goal is to, okay, what are the people doing on the ground? And how can we talk about what the people are doing on the ground On one hand, while we are also making demands on the people that are supposed to be responsible for these people, on the other hand, so I'm also framing most of these marginal spaces like Makoko, which is my doctoral field site, as a site of innovation and ingenuity. And it's interestingly, there is increasing level of global inequality in the world today. So, and how can we study what people are doing on the ground in these marginal spaces amid increasing inequality? So, and I'm also interested in you know, presenting community-based approaches, just like I mentioned, and just like anthropologist Richard mentioned with the people science, as integral components of global health. And that all global health, most of the global health interventions, instead of demonizing some of the local approaches that the people are using to manage their problems, should pay attention to how, you know, they can incorporate these local approaches into the planning and execution of global health projects. So again, disease is a global phenomenon that is not unique to Africa or Nigeria. It is something that affects different parts of the world. So I also wanted to say a little bit about my positionality as a Nigerian who was born and raised in Nigeria and is attending university in a global North university and is now undertaking research in Nigeria. So when I started this research, I was like, oh, I'm in Nigeria. I've lived my entire life in Nigeria. The only time I've ever left Nigeria for an extended period was when I came to Iowa in 2019 to start my doctoral degree. So I was like, oh, I should be considered an insider in this context. But I found that I've had to negotiate the insider-outsider position in different contexts in Nigeria, despite the fact that I'm in Nigeria nationally. What do I mean by this? In certain situations, for instance, if I'm going on the street of Lagos, because I speak some of the dominant languages in the country, I speak the Yoruba language that is spoken in the southwestern region of the country, and the Pidgin English, which is much more, which has a wider spread across the length and breadth of the country. So I consider myself an insider. Well, however, I noticed that when I get to Makoko, especially during the early stages of my research, I was considered an outsider. So, and my goal then was to say, how do I transform from this, you know, outsider social identity into being, you know, seen as also someone who understands the local context, who grew up in the country, who understands the dynamics of the social, who have a lived experience of the socioeconomic inequality that we see in the country. So, and again, I've noticed that as an insider, in places where I fit as an insider, like maybe going to meet people to interview them and stuff, my social identity as an insider is sort of reinforced by my good understanding of local context and terminology. So it's very easy for me, you know, to understand local context and terminologies in so many local contexts in southwestern Nigeria, where my research is taking place. And also, I have a good understanding of the dominant languages, like I said, the Yoruba language and the Pidgin English. And my identity as an insider within the Nigerian context gives me access to different contexts in the countries. But as an outsider, especially in my field side, despite my efforts, you know, to sort of, you know, gain that privilege of being considered or being viewed as an insider, as being belonging, you know, to the broader social network, I noticed that in the community, there's this constant suspicion that, oh, this person is not one of us. And I noticed that this suspicion is exacerbated by the fact that the Makoko community where I'm conducting research is a community that is constantly negotiating its legitimacy with the Lagos State government. As a matter of fact, in the past, we've had instances that instead of government officials to sort of create solutions, to say, oh, we want to help you, we want to, like they did when they built Banana Island, they surfaced the entire place, they created road networks and stuff like that. Instead of the government to do that for them, we've seen situations in the past that government went into the community with bulldozers, with tractors to demolish buildings. Of course, these actions were met with huge resistance from the people to say, if you want to send us out of this place, you have to create alternatives for us. So, and because of this, people ask me a lot of times, who are you? Are you working for the government? Are you a government agent? And then I have to, you know, sort of explain myself several times to say, hey, I'm a Nigerian who is interested in XYZ project. And also, one tool that I think has helped me so far to sort of reduce the outsider barrier in the community where I'm doing my research is an anthropological method, which is called participant observation. Very simply, the concept of participant observation is just saying, as a researcher, as an anthropologist, we have a duty to immerse ourselves into the culture and the community that we are studying, spend time with the people, hang out with the people, ask people questions. And then, so this is a tool that I've used to sort of reduce the outsider barrier significantly. So I started spending a lot of time in the community, sleeping in the community, you know, hanging out with the people. I participated in several community-led initiatives, like sand filling of large puddles of waterlogged areas. I participated in caregiving activities, malaria caregiving activities in several contexts. I followed people, you know, as they sort of navigate different stages of seeking therapy when they are infected with the malaria disease. So that sort of, I noticed that sort of reduced, because now, even sometimes when I'm in the community, people are like, oh, you are one of us. And, you know, they see me as being an insider in this context. So, and just to sort of show some of the pictures where, you know, I was participating in different endeavors in the community. The picture by my right was a day when a medical hospital in Lagos came to do eye screening for the people. And being in the community, I participated very actively in the process. And also, by my left is a traditional healer who was explaining how they were making herbs, and in a very clean and hygienic way, how they make herbs to sort of treat malaria patients, and explaining some of the strategies that they use to build infrastructure, including makeshift hospitals, to treat themselves when they get infected by the. And of course, this was me at different times of the night, midnight, morning, you know, sort of hanging out with community members, playing games with community members, asking questions about some of the things that they do in the community. And also here on my right, so I think around 2 a.m. one day, I was very hungry and I was talking to one of the community members, and they were like, oh, you're hungry, should I make you noodles? And then they were so gracious to, you know, cook some indomie that saved me that particular night. So I wanted to be sure that we have enough time to, you know, discuss in case there are questions, there are areas that I need to clarify more. So I will welcome those questions and, of course, probe. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, I thank the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council for giving me the opportunity to talk about my work, especially as I move into the phase of writing my dissertation. I thank you so much for the platform. Huge thanks specifically for my advisor, Professor Powers, who has provided a very useful guidance, and I've truly benefited from his wealth of knowledge and experience in, you know, constantly revising and revising the questions I have in the field and even in life generally. Huge thanks to my committee members, Department of Anthropology, again, Iowa City Foreign Relations Council, and thank you all for listening to my talk today.
All right, excellent. Thank you very much, Ebenezer. So we'll now move to the question and answer portion of the program. For those with a question, please raise your hand and I'll bring the microphone to you. But before we begin the question and answer period, and to give you a minute to kind of develop your thoughts into kind of the format of a question, the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council wants to thank its supporters and donors for their support. If you'd like to join the Foreign Relations Council or make a gift to support our programs, please go to icfrc.org or check out one of the signs that are stationed in the rooms today. And thank you. So for those who do have a question, please just raise your hand and I'll come with the microphone because Ebenezer needs us to speak to the microphone to hear us because it loops back through the online system to reach him in Nigeria. So any questions from the group? Yes.
Thank you for your presentation. And can you talk a little bit about where you're going from here with your research and what are the next steps as you move forward?
Ebenezer, why don't we take questions one by one and I'll wait to ask the next person until after you've answered this one. Does that sound okay?
Yeah, that's okay. Thank you so much for the question. Regarding the next step in my career, like I mentioned when I was closing this talk, I'm at this stage now in my doctoral, in my pursuit of doctoral degree where I need to start writing my dissertation. So the next couple of months will be dedicated to analysis of my data and actually putting things out there, especially explaining how people talk about their own social processes and their own social situation. So my goal in the next couple of months is to actually put all of these things into writing. And of course, send draft out for publication. And my goal is to sort of promote, help the people in the promotion of their own agency. It is not my, I'm just like a vehicle that is being used to sort of amplify their voices in the community. But in terms of career goal, I don't know what the future holds, but in terms of the next phase in the project, it's for me to sit down and see what aspect of my data I want to focus on, in consultation with my advisor, and write my dissertation, and hopefully which will lead into books and articles in the future. Thank you.
Thanks. Ebenezer, thank you so much for this beautiful presentation. And as a Nigerian myself, I think that this is an amazing work you're doing. One of the things that I have a lot of problems with, I think this is a global phenomenon, the issue of sustainability. And I think that sustainability and in anthropology is also very, very important. As you go through your CDI concept and theory of community-developed infrastructure, and looking at Makoko, what do you think of sustainability in terms of the processes of what they do? And because in most cases, sometimes you find some of those non-governmental agencies and some of international organizations come in, and some of the things they bring in are actually not sustainable. It seems like what you're telling me is what the communities are doing are probably going to be more sustainable. How would you justify that? What do you see on the ground that makes you feel that the CDI is going to be sustainable?
Yeah, thank you so much. In terms of the sustainability of the community development infrastructure that I'm seeing in the community, one thing I've noticed is that the project, most of these infrastructural, community-led infrastructural development initiatives are planned and executed by community members themselves. They tend to be very sustainable. I'll give an example. So we are just living the rainy season in Nigeria. And during one of my walks around the community, I saw a very long wooden bridge And I was very curious because the science put into building that bridge was incredible. And I was like, oh, I was asking my research participants who built this bridge, and they told me the community built it. And I was like, has there ever been a situation whereby this bridge fell? Maybe there was heavy rainfall and then it wiped the bridge away. And they were like, oh, there were several instances where there were a couple of instances where the bridge fell, a very long wooden bridge. But because it was a project that was, you know, executed by community members, they had different ways of pulling resources together amongst themselves to rebuild the bridge. And they built something they could manage. That's another thing with community developed infrastructure. And that's the difference between, that's the major difference between community development, developed infrastructure, and infrastructure that are, you know, given by, that are provided by maybe NGOs, by international organizations. What I've seen on the ground is the fact that many people just go into the community. I've seen that a lot since I started my PhD, without really working with community members. And they just say, oh, we think they need this, without asking the people what will really benefit them. I will give another example. I have not seen any public hospital, any government hospital in Magogo. Of course, there are pockets of government hospitals in neighboring communities. But since I started my doctoral research, I've not seen any government hospital. But one day, one of my research participants took me to a hospital, which was situated in a neighboring community, it's called Ayetoro community. And the hospital was donated by a very famous international organization, which I will not want to mention here today. But however, they told me that the hospital got shut down at some point when the organization left, and then the community could not pay the doctors. And before the organization left, the organization did not train, you know, community members or work with community members on how to maintain the hospital. So because of that sole reason, the hospital had to be shut down when the organization left, and they couldn't pay the doctors, they couldn't maintain the health equipment. And eventually, because it's in the neighboring community, I think government eventually came over to say, oh, what can we do about this community? So what I've seen on the ground a lot of times is the fact that many nonprofit organizations, NGOs, go into communities like this to institute projects without really bringing the voices and expertise of the people who have lived the experience of the community into the design and implementation of the project. But I noticed that some of the projects that community members initiate themselves are very sustainable. They maintain this project. If there's any problem with the project, they tend to fix it. Thank you.
Ebenezer, thank you very much. Your presentation today was excellent, and I'm struck by the meaningfulness of the research that you're conducting there, and I applaud you for that. It's an excellent doctoral project. I'm thinking about two things that you only touched on a little bit, and I'd love for you to expand on. I have lots of questions, but I'm going to keep them to just these two. The first is, would you talk a little bit about what you've seen in, especially in the Makoko community with children? How are children impacted by malaria in ways that are similar or different to other folks in the community, adults in particular? And I'm also wondering about the involvement of children, perhaps as they get to be a little bit older, maybe in their teenage years, perhaps, into how they do get involved in the community's efforts to combat malaria and to have a healthier, more sustainable lifestyle themselves living in that area. And my second question sort of, I guess it sort of relates. I'm wondering, how do you foresee your research, your doctoral dissertation, benefiting the folks that you're working with? Have you given thought to this? And if so, how would you like your research to benefit them? Thanks.
Thank you for the question. Regarding how children are impacted by malaria in Makoko, I think children are much more impacted, at least from my findings so far. And like I mentioned in my presentation earlier, I participated in a lot of efforts aimed at, you know, sort of seeking therapy for children specifically that are impacted by malaria. So children are impacted by malaria, especially young children who are just born and who have not developed the kind of immune response that the adults, to fight off the malaria infection when they are infected. So children are definitely very impacted. However, since this is a community, just talking about the second aspect of the first question about the involvement of children in community-led initiatives as they grow older. So what I've found so far is the fact that children who remain in the community as they grow older, through the process of, you know, watching what the elderly ones are doing, also get to contribute as they grow older to community-led initiatives when they get to the age where they can. For instance, I've seen, you know, young folks who also, you know, sort of participate in clearing the gutters, clearing the canals and stuff like that, and also trying to fix mosquito nets around strategic areas. So as they grow older, of course, during childhood, they rely heavily on their parents to provide therapy, to provide healthcare and other things that they might need. But as they grow older, they also tend to participate in community-led initiatives for sort of reducing their exposure to malaria and also to also, you know, be responsible for family members who might be struck down by the disease in the later years. And regarding how my research can benefit the community, this is a question I grapple with all the time. This is the question I get to ask. I get asked by community members all the time. When I talk to them, I'm like, oh, I'm here for XYZ, I'm here to understand XYZ. Some of the most prominent questions I've gotten are, how will your research benefit our community? And I've given it a lot of thought, and I'm also very open to suggestions today because I'm also in the phase of learning how to improve my approach, how to improve my project. So one of the things I'm trying to do with my work is to sort of, you know, make my work accessible to policymakers, especially the government. Of course, that is very complicated, and I do not have the kind of, you know, connect, but who knows, in the future, if I find myself in some of these positions where I can definitely do something on the ground beyond just writing about it. And another thing I'm trying to do is to sort of amplify the voices of the people to, you know, to for their voices to get to the appropriate places. And hopefully one day it's going to get to the appropriate places and to people who really need to do something within the community. So those are the ways I've really thought about it, to sort of promote the voices of the people, and hope that my work at some point will get to decision makers. And also, since it's a huge problem, tying back to another earlier question about sustainability, to sort of, you know, to sort of contribute to debate in global health, to say, if you want to initiate any global health project in communities like this, you can't just come from, you know, Washington, D.C. Or the CDC office to say, oh, we know what the problem is on the ground. Our donors and international organizations need to really, really spend time to understand the real problems in the community and listen to community needs. So that is also what I'm trying to do with my work, to say the voices of the people matter. They have the lived experience. Some of them have been living in the community for several years, so they need to be carried along in the process of planning and executing the project, so that when the donor leaves, like the hospital, that the people that gave them the hospital did the other time, the community will have been empowered to sustain the project beyond the international organizations giving. Thank you.
Probably continue on with this conversation for some time longer, Dr. Gerlach, do we have time for any more questions? It's 1 o'clock. What would you advise? Is there one more question from the group before we end for today? All right, if there's no more questions, I want to thank Ebenezer so much for his excellent program today. This was the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's 7th program for the fall. Our next program features a 7-2023 International Writers Program Fall Residence. Kevin Chen from Taiwan, Temi Leiming Ho and Wang Yieva from Hong Kong, Li Kotomi from Taiwan and Japan, Xi Yingfeng, Suo Er, and Wang Zhanhe from the People's Republic of China, apologies for mispronunciation, which is moderated and translated by poet Jennifer Feely, who will be speaking about writing across the sinosphere. Join us for that from 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. on Thursday, the 19th of October, right here in the Iowa City Public Library for an engaging bilingual reading of leading contemporary writers. If you haven't done so already, there are paper copies of the Humanities Iowa sign-in form. It would be great if you could add your name and contact information to one of those before you leave. In addition, there are paper copies of the Humanities Iowa program survey. We'd appreciate if you could fill out one and leave it with us. With that, thank you again for joining us today, and we are adjourned.